Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators in the UK and beyond. Hello and welcome to today's episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, I'm really excited to have Janet Shah Rajan with me. Janet started her journey in venture within finance, having spent several years at AXA Venture Partners, a sector agnostic fund investing in Series B and beyond, before jumping across the table, having spent the last year at Hopin, where she's currently head of strategic finance. Hopin, for those of you that don't know, is a virtual and hybrid events platform and one of Europe's fastest growing scale-ups. Janet continues to invest in startups as an angel and is focused on women-led businesses. Janet, thank you so much for joining me. It's really great to have you here today.
Thanks for having me here, Arish. Really good to be here.
No problem at all. We're going to jump right into it. So it'd be great to understand a little bit about your general background and kind of what led you to jump to the other side of the table from investing to operating, because you kind of started your career in finance and only relatively recently went into the operation side of things. So it'd be great to get a bit of flavor on that.
Yeah, that's right. So I think as long as I can remember, I always wanted to be in and around businesses. And the advice that I was given when I was studying sort of economics at A level and did maths as my undergrad was, you do well in finance. That's where you can arguably learn about businesses and how they operate and how they work. And it's just a really good training ground. So yeah, I did start via the very traditional route of investment banking and then made the leap into investing, because that does take you that bit closer to businesses, particularly startups, where arguably more hustle and business happens. And then I had a great run in venture, was with AXA Venture Partners for their fund one. So I was the first non-partner employee there and built out their operations, but also invested alongside them on everything. And then after fund one was pretty much deployed and they were thinking about fund two, my sense was, I've had a great time here. It's been a few years, but in terms of my growth and where I originally wanted to be in life, being in-house in a business seems like the next thing to do. So transitioning out of investing felt like the right thing to do for my personal growth and also to align better with where I wanted to be in life and career. So my idea of a transition was to do a coding boot camp as a sort of pseudo MBA in between the two. And then I consulted for a few companies before luckily stumbling upon and joining Hopin.
That's quite the journey. Actually, as you were talking, a thought kind of came to my mind, and it's not something we've talked about too much before, but you come from a very similar background to me in terms of cultural and geographical backgrounds. Our families, I think, were both from Kenya, originally East African. There's a huge kind of entrepreneurial vein that runs through kind of our community. Is that something that you think had an influence as well on that desire to get into business, or was it very much kind of just the way you were built and, you know, what you wanted to do?
I'm pretty sure that upbringing and environment had a big impact. For avoidance of doubt, we're not related. You and I met through the tech industry and just clicked. And then later we found out we went to the same secondary school as well, albeit maybe in slightly different cohorts. But yeah, from East Africa. So my parents were born and raised in Nairobi in Kenya. And I am the only member of my family, actually, who was born and raised in London when they happened to settle here at various times in their lives. And I think my perception of our community and families and Shah people in general, and Gujaratis overall, is that those who went particularly via East Africa had to be pretty enterprising to set up life there, to create jobs for themselves, to create income for themselves, to create any sense of wealth for themselves. So there is this idea of hustle that I think is pretty intrinsic in the family. Whenever there is an idea, you're almost encouraged to pursue it, but you're also nowadays encouraged to pursue studies, which I think I've definitely been afforded more opportunities than my parents have. And I also think that's generally a generational thing. Our parents give us more opportunities than they had. So generationally, my observation is that there are some people who perhaps look at white collar jobs as perhaps better than business, but I think the startup environment has turned the tables again and made it the cool thing to do. So Yeah, I definitely think upbringing and seeing how, you know, my parents' minds worked. They were very opportunistic, very thrifty, but always very, very aware when there was an opportunity around and to evaluate it and do and build. So yeah, I owe a lot to my upbringing and background as well. And I think that had a huge influence in what I wanted to do and where I am today.
That's incredible. And I think we could probably do an entire podcast just exploring that whole diaspora and how that entrepreneurial spirit kind of moved from India to Africa. And then I think 100% agree with you. The number of conversations I think I've had with people my age who went into law or accountancy or medicine or, you know, the traditional career paths, which is, you know, as you say, kind of what the aspirations have become when you start educating your kids through further education, etc., who now are sort of sitting there going, gosh, I really wish I could get, you know, into something entrepreneurial. I just don't know where to start. So I think it's kind of come full circle, which is really great to see. And I think, as you say, it is changing. So moving on to Hopin, I'd love to dig in a little bit there. So, you know, Hopin is one of the fastest scaling ventures out there. It's ramped up ARR to $70 million earlier this year. You know, it's reported as having grown from a base of about 20 million ARR late last year. So what have been the challenges from a finance and operations perspective that you've had to deal with as Hopin went through this growth? It'd be great to understand kind of how, you know, you've been able to scale that quickly.
Yeah, there are glamorous problems and there are not so glamorous problems, you know. So let's start with the not so glamorous, you know, the systems and infrastructure, the plumbing. You know you need it, so you put in an ERP, a CRM, various processes, and you outgrow them. So you start with something that is maybe on a Notion doc, and then you implement a freemium kind of tool, maybe a HubSpot or a QuickBooks or a Xero. And then you need to go enterprise grade very, very quickly across all your systems. And you always feel like you're kind of playing catch up. The way we are in our finance team at Hopin is we don't think of ourselves as back office. We're very involved and we're very front office. Yes, we're fulfilling a back office need as well, but we're very strategic in how we think. But at the same time, when it comes to the plumbing of the data of the business, keeping the lights on, you always feel like you're a bit on the back foot when you have to upgrade your ERP system and you don't have a traditional year to do your migration. You have a matter of months before you totally outgrow what you had before. So those are the not so glamorous problems. And then obviously on the more venture side of things, it's been really incredible to have a front row seat and contribute to the Series B, the Series C, and the Series D, and numerous acquisitions. You know, it really is a boot camp and a crash course in how finance works. You do acquisitions, you do capital raising, you do the operations and the, you know, P&L management. There's so much activity all the time at Hopin that it's also a challenge to prioritize, you know, when you could do everything, which is the case for everyone. It's not unique to Hopin, but to an extent, we have done everything. And I think it's got us to a really good place. And now we need to double down on what we have and keep going. There is a relentless spirit about Hopin and there's a lot of hustle. I'd say all my colleagues are really entrepreneurial themselves and everyone puts it into what they do at Hopin. It's really magic. But I'd say challenges are keeping up on a financial level.
Yeah, we've talked about it a few times on this podcast, and I think the importance of having the infrastructure in place as you scale is incredibly important, right? So I think the way we've talked about it previously is, you know, startups thrive on chaos, but actually if you want to scale, you need structure because you need systems that can scale as you grow, right? And I think it's that kind of analogy of, I don't know, building the scaffolding as you're, you know, underneath you as you're building the house or something, right? And I think, you know, one of the things that I know you and I have talked about, and I think it's really important way of thinking about things is Hopin. I think you segregated your strategic finance from your operational finance, right? So you gave yourselves the ability to be very, very focused on what are two quite different activities with any kind of business, and certainly within venture-backed businesses. And I think that's, you know, it's an education for a lot of founders that finance isn't this homogenous kind of just veneer of numbers that, you know, if you're an accountant, you can do finance. And I think you and I have joked about all accountants say they work in finance and all finance people say they're not accountants, right? So how is that segregation kind of the strategic versus the operational? How's that played into things?
Yeah, we have a finance organization that now comprises of accounting as our biggest function, includes payroll and revenue recognition, technical accounting, accounts receivable, accounts payable, etc. So, you know, we've gotten to that enterprise grade team. And then we have our finance or FP&A team. That's where I sit. And we think about the strategy and planning of the business and monitoring and tracking and generating insight. And we also have a procurement team. Given how large Hopin is, we need to manage our contracts with our vendors. So we have a procurement team of a few people now, and we have investor relations as well, which used to be kind of everybody's job, but it really is, given the number of fundraisers we've done, the number of acquisitions we've done, it makes sense to now have a function for that. So, but specifically on the sort of two sides of the coin are accounting and finance or FP&A. Accounting is necessary. Everybody needs to be able to monitor their business, make sure it's compliant, book official P&Ls, balance sheets, cash flows. It's necessary. You need to be able to collect cash from your customers. You need to be able to pay your providers. Accounting is an essential function. Finance takes it that step further of how do we use that accounting data plus data from the business, and how do we plan? How do we communicate our performance? It's my happy place because we're extremely data driven. We're thinking about strategy. We're thinking about how to improve aspects of the business, how to diagnose aspects of the business that might need a little bit more investigation if performance isn't what we expected or if behaviors aren't what we thought. So that finance function is also necessary because when you need to communicate to your board, you need to communicate to investors, or you broadly need to just have an understanding of, well, how much headcount do we need next year to deliver on this plan? What do we need to prioritize and invest in terms of our own cash, operating cash? Where do we need to put it? Where do we need more CapEx? That's where finance really comes in to help enable those strategic decisions. So for founders, my biggest advice would be don't expect your accountant to do your fundraising, because the expectations on fundraising are very different. You know, the metrics we talk about in accounting and finance are different. You and I have talked about our pet peeve when people confuse GMV and ARR with revenue. Gross merchandise value and annualized recurring revenue are not the revenue that you book in your accounts. And this is just a basic example of where finance thinking and accounting thinking diverge. Yes, we're two sides of the same coin and we care about each other's metrics, but we track and work off and plan for different things.
So I think that's a really, really important point, right? So, I mean, it's something that obviously we talk about, or I talk about a lot as kind of a CFO and operating CFO in a lot of ventures, right? It's taking yourself away from the pure accounting metrics, you know, gross profitability, EBITDA, all of these things are important, right? But actually the metrics that matter in a business from a finance perspective, from a growth perspective, from a leading kind of metrics perspective, it may be very, very different from what is traditional accounting, right? The reason accounting exists is to give ability to compare, right? So it's to standardize things so that you can look at two businesses that are in relatively the same space and kind of compare them on a like-for-like basis. But the metrics that you as a business track and that inform the decisions that you make, I think can be really, really different. So what are those North Star metrics, you know, for you and for Hopin?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about ARR, headcount, operating cash flow, but those are really table stakes. And I don't think that sets any business apart in terms of what they should be tracking, what they are tracking. I'd say at Hopin, we're pretty obsessed with the customer and we're very customer focused. And that's why a lot of our metrics that we track, financial and non-financial, more also KPIs, have that lens in mind. So we care about NPS, Net Promoter Score, not classically a finance metric, but we do try and look for correlations between that and how our business is performing. And then I'd say, you know, taking ARR one step further is your net dollar retention, your NDR. You might have ARR today, but can you keep that cohort tomorrow? Is your customer loving you enough to stay with you? Are they advocating for you? Are they spending more with you as they go on? Is that NDR increasing? I think that matters for all SaaS businesses. Again, it's not unique to us, but I think the care and emphasis we put on it is a trademark of Hopin.
So again, that's super interesting. I think the way I've often described it is that a lot of growth ventures focus on acquisition, not on retention. The problem is when you're scaling, if you're just bringing on new customers, but you're not actually taking care of your existing customers, ultimately that's going to lead to a lot of churn, and that's going to lead to, you know, issues down the track. And equally, it's much easier to service and delight and grow a customer that you already have than to constantly be adding new customers, right? And I think that's been, a realization for a lot of ventures over the course of the last couple of years, and obviously across the pandemic, I would say that that's probably been more the case, is how do you service the customers that you do have? Because, you know, you may not be able to acquire new customers quickly or certainly efficiently. So it's all about making sure you can extend that lifetime, reduce churn, and as you say, you know, really focus on net dollar retention. So I want to move back to investment now. So there's clearly been a lot of activity in the investment world around kind of focus on diverse founders and teams. Certainly over the course of the last year and a half, there's been a lot of advocacy and I guess spotlights on these sort of things. Why is that important to you in terms of your activity as an angel? And how do you think it's now being reflected in the wider ecosystem?
Yeah, I think taking a step back and taking a step backwards from my activity as an angel when I was in VC, you know, you look at the deal flow and you think it doesn't take much analysis really to realize, even anecdotally, your deal flow is not diverse. You can try, but the deal flow is not. Some of it is a reflection of the team around you and the partnership and what where their relationships are. Maybe their relationships are not diverse, but part of it is I was also a Series B investor. And, you know, to get to Series B, you're either bootstrapped and you have some 5 million in ARR being bootstrapped and then suddenly you raise around, or you've gone through the earlier venture motions. And I think that at the earlier venture motions, that qualification is unfortunately not in favor of diversity and minorities. And that's where the problem lies. So if I can, in my very small, tiny wallet way, do something about that and be proactive in investing in companies that either resonate with me because they serve problems that I understand and also have a diverse founder base, I think that's the best contribution I can make as an investor off my own bat.
So recently I had a conversation, and I think you've described it from the other way around, but it's basically the similar concept, right? You have to have the right people at the table. You have to have diversity at the table. And, you know, in this conversation, we talked about the fact that if LPs are not diverse, then, you know, they're not going to invest in diverse GPs. And if diverse GPs aren't there, then they're going to struggle to invest in diverse founders. And if you don't get diversity in the founding team, then you're not going to get diversity throughout the organization. So it
the whole supply chain.
Yeah, cascades from one to the other. And I think the thing that seems to be changing, it'd be great to understand whether you think that this is the case or not, but there seem to have been more funds being raised by solo GPs, certainly in the US, maybe less so in the UK, but solo GPs, people of color, female GPs, maybe younger sort of millennial, Gen X, Gen Z, I don't know, kind of GPs. Well, I guess, do you think that we're seeing that in the UK at the moment? And do you think that that's having an impact? Is that improving things? Or is there a risk of kind of flooding the market and, you know, you potentially have, you know, a lot of failure, which then kind of gets an I told you so from those that, you know, haven't been advocating for diversity up until now?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I listened to your conversation with Hussein Kanji on this podcast, I believe you did it a few months ago, and you know, what he had to say about the LP funnel was the honest truth. I still think that the US is ahead of us in tackling these diversity challenges, for giving opportunities or creating opportunity for individual solo GPs, for younger GPs for minority GPs. I don't think we're quite there yet here. You do hear of some smaller boutique funds coming up. I think my take on the venture market in Europe is that Europe was slow in figuring it out. If you look at the top brands, top venture brands that have kind of established themselves and planted their flag in Europe, they are predominantly American. There are a few examples of funds that have planted their flag, homegrown, built it up. And I also have slight, I guess, cultural connotations with thinking of Europe as homegrown, because I always have this idea of I'm from everywhere. But anyway, I think it kind of trickles down where even the partners who mature out of the big funds, they are maturing out of those, they have the LP relationships, and then they go and spin out. People spin out of Index and set up their own fund. People spin out of Accel and set up their own fund. Tiger Global has this concept of cubs in the US. So that's more the movement that I see in Europe. I haven't necessarily seen a tech personality that we know from Twitter beyond, say, Harry Stebbings raising a fund in Europe. And I think there's a lot of room for that to happen, and it needs to happen. We need that movement here because ultimately it does result in diversity of funding. Harry Stebbings recently funded a Pakistani startup scale up. So things will happen once we give the next generation the tools to do it. I don't think Europe is there yet. And I am optimistic about what we can do for diversity. I just challenge some of the means that we're using in Europe to do it. And you and I have had a few conversations. My critique comes from a well-intended place, but I don't think that the diversity initiatives that are currently running in Europe are necessarily having the correct effect. I feel like my impression after talking to diverse founders is that, yeah, we're offered a ton of mentorship, but no dollar, no coin.
I think that's a really solid take on kind of the state of the nation, if I can put it that way. One has to hope that, you know, we will see more Harrys. Like, you know, Harry inspired me to do this podcast in an odd way, I would say, probably. But it is incredible the journey that he's been on and where he's gotten to, and how he's been able to raise, you know, a nine-figure fund straight off the bat. You know, I think is testament to the fact that there is appetite out there, you know, to start moving in that direction. So I think that is great. I mean, from your perspective as an investor, you know, I'd love to understand, what is it that you look for in the businesses that you back? You know, what is it that it has to have to get you excited? Is it the market, the team? Is it a particular sector? Is it the metrics? Or is it something else altogether? Because I find there tend to be people that talk about investment from a programmatic kind of perspective. And my take on that is, if you're programmatic, then you're missing the outliers, which are the gems that one should be looking for. So what is it that you look for?
Yeah, I'd say it's kind of 50% characteristics and then 50% my intuition. So when you're an angel investor and you're not working for a fund, you also have the liberty of investing in things that you feel more passionate about. So I have to share the passion of what the founders are doing. I don't just want to invest for financial return. We could all invest in, you know, a steady state SaaS business that has good LTV CAC and, you know, that it's a well-oiled machine and it works. But where's the excitement in that? So I look for, you know, first, is the idea fun? Can I relate to it? Would I be a customer of it if it is B2C? You know, often if they're B2B, would I, as an enterprise customer, could I be a customer of it? I think that those are kind of key things for me to know. I have an empathy and understanding. I don't like investing in things where I don't understand. If it's some space astronaut technology, you know, I have no desire to be an astronaut. I'm not going to benefit from it, and I have nothing to advise or suggest. So probably don't take my money. But so far as other characteristics go, I think teams who have a certain culture about them, I like it when teams have, my husband hates this phrase, but I can't think of a better one for this, is bias for action. It's very easy to create a nice deck and say you're going to do all these things, but, you know, where is the proof of action? What have you done to validate it? What have you done to try? So people who just kind of get on with it, I work well with in the real world, but also I think they're the best to invest in. People who know they don't have everything 100% correct, but they're willing to try, they're willing to learn, and you can tell that they're they're learning as they go. I think I'm wary of founders who say, we know everything, we know what we're doing. You know, I watch out to see how they do, just because I think, yeah, good for you. I'm not saying that I have the answers to their problems, not at all. I'm not saying they have to learn from me, but just having that idea that, yes, I am going on a journey. Maybe I have the idea down. I know my market, but maybe I need to figure out execution as I go. So that being prepared to learn. And then, yeah, I have to believe that the market is large. If it's quite niche, it's also hard to really advise unless you're an expert in that niche. And I think of myself as a generalist, so I don't have any niche expertise. If I have any expertise at all, that's another question. So yeah, I'd say having a shared passion for their industry or product or what they're doing, believing in the culture and the ambition of the team and how they can deliver is what I really look for, and a market that is appealing and has a size or could have a size in the future.
Yeah, I think super interesting, because I think a lot of people, when they think about early stage investing, they think that there is some sort of template that you can follow. And I guess exactly as you say, there isn't. And in fact, you know, you talk about looking at the business and wondering whether you would be a consumer of their product or potentially a buyer of their product if you're an enterprise. You know, I often think about it for a lot of things, because I'm a bit of an old curmudgeon at times. I don't use all the tech all the time. So I look to my daughters to see, you know, what are they doing and how would they sort of bring it into their kind of lives. And depending on whether or not, you know, it's something that they would buy into, maybe it's something that I'd buy into. So I think that's really interesting. And I think a lot of people who are getting into angel investing at the moment would find that really valuable. And I think one of the other things that you and I have talked about a little bit is small check investing and the value of experience over just the cash. It'd be great to kind of get a little bit of a flavor from you on your thoughts there.
Yeah, I think you and I started talking about it when I got a lot of inbound deal flow where, you know, the minimum check was 50K or 100K at a time. And I thought, what do they think I have done in life that I have these reserves of wealth? I'm really not. The biggest check I've ever invested is £10,000. So, you know, and for me, that's a material decision to do that, given where I am in life and also my risk appetite. So I've done that a few times, but my smallest check has been $1,000. And I think what people don't realize is that both founders don't realize, and both founders and aspirational angel investors aren't clear that you can do this. So there are multiple ways of doing this, and in that founders, if they find it too cumbersome to take, you know, hundreds of $1,000 checks, you can syndicate. There are platforms like Odin, Voga, AngelList itself, and I'm sure there are others, but used all of these in the past when founders have said, you know, we want to keep cap table cleaner. It would be nicer if you were all in an SPV and, you know, invested in that syndicate. So there are ways to get around sort of the mechanics of it, but ultimately for a founder, the more advocates you have, the more people you have in your corner. Okay, some people might be more well connected than others, but you know, getting alignment by taking in their money is one thing, and then knowing that they might advocate for you or bat for you in front of your prospective customers, in front of your prospective new hires, in front of your prospective future investors. Your network becomes so much larger by leveraging the network of your angel investor base. And I think it's fantastic to see more microcheck investors in the angel space, because I think that is another way of promoting diversity in the whole ecosystem. Recently, I did a micro LP check where I wrote a £5,000 check into a reasonably well-known fund in Europe. And this is another way that we can create diversity, but also level the playing field for even the ultimate supply chain into this whole venture ecosystem.
Yes. And I think just echoing what you said there around the kind of micro LP checks, you know, there's a couple of first time fund managers in the US, and, you know, they're raising sort of $5 million, $10 million funds, and they're taking checks, you know, from $10,000 to $25,000 as a starting check size. So it's, you know, that barrier to entry has been lowered so much, and that friction, I think, has been removed to the extent that anyone can now start participating in the ecosystem. You know, this is without even talking about platforms like Cedars and Crowdcube and so on. So I think all power to you that you are, you know, out there you know, making these investments and really, you know, backing your gut, but also backing what you believe in, I guess. Just as we kind of round things off, I just had a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question, maybe. Which side of the table do you actually prefer, investment or operating?
That's a really tough one. I would say that being an operator or having experience being an operator, continuing to experience being an operator, makes me a better investor. I think it gives me more depth, more empathy, more understanding. But I also think being an investor has in some ways made me a better operator, in that I have more of an understanding of what we need to deliver as a business, particularly at a business like Hopin, where we are clearly venture-backed, we are clearly going for growth. We are an ambitious team. We have an ambitious leadership. We have an ambitious, fearless leader. So yeah, but I think, you know, it might be a cop-out answer, but I've spent more time as an investor. I still consider the time I invest as an angel as being investment time. I'm still an active investor in companies. So I would say my DNA is probably a little bit more investor than it is operator.
Yeah, I don't think there is a right answer, right, for anyone. And to your point, both inform the other when you're operating in venture or whether you're investing. Like if you've operated, that's going to hopefully help you make better investment decisions, because you may have seen some of the challenges or the pitfalls. And equally, you know, if you've been on the investor side, you understand what is going to scale, you know, what are the things that look like success, and therefore you can bring them into the venture when you're operating. Janet, I really want to thank you for your time today. It's been absolutely incredible exploring your journey and all of these topics, from Hopin to the investment side of things. For our listeners, where could they find you? Are you on LinkedIn? Are you on Twitter? Where's the best place to look for you?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. I have a lot of fun there. So I'm at Janet Shah on Twitter, and I'm also on LinkedIn, but I'm probably most active on Twitter, where I don't take it too seriously, but love to meet people there.
Awesome. Janet, thank you so much for joining me. Have a great day ahead. It's been wonderful talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Irish. You have a great day as well. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. We'd love to get your feedback and thoughts on our conversations, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop me a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?